We are right in the middle at the moment of a US presidential election season, which, not for the first time, has some odd Irish resonances. Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, for example, in his 2016 memoir Hillbilly Elegy, describes himself as identifying with the millions of working-class white Americans of Scots-Irish descent who have no college degree. For her part, although her heritage is unlikely to entice her to Ireland to research her genealogy, Kamala Harris is descended through her Jamaican father from a particularly enthusiastic Irish-born slave owner, Hamilton Brown. In a recent book, Race, Politics and Irish America, Professor Mary Burke of the University of Connecticut explores Irish-American identities. Note the use of the plural. Earlier, I spoke to Mary about how the history of Irish emigration and its intersections with race, class and culture have shaped these identities. So Mary, Irish emigration to the USA begins to take off in the 18th century, but there were a couple of distinctive types of emigration. So can you differentiate between pre- and post-famine Irish emigration?
I think we know a lot about post-famine, but pre is interesting. So only about a third of Ireland's population were Protestants, you know, in the 18th century, but they constituted 75% of transatlantic departures between the years of 1700 and 1776. And about 70% of these Protestant immigrants were actually Presbyterians of Scottish settler origin. And by 1790, half of the 400,000 US residents who were, you know, usually labelled Irish, these actually descended from this particular Ulster stock.
Even in the 18th century, you identify different waves of Irish emigration. So how were the earlier emigrants different from those who left Ireland, say, after the devastating famine of 1741?
Yeah, so the first wave of emigration from Ulster occurred from 1718 onwards. And that wave was, you know, made up of those who could raise the cost of their passage. But the second wave, which started about 1740, this was different. This was poor indentured servants. And James Leyburn, the great sort of scholar of the Ulster Irish, he estimates that, quote, not less than half nor more than two-thirds of all white emigrants to the colonies were indentured servants or redemptioners or convicts, end quote. And he suggests that beginning in 1728, by far the greatest number of servants actually came from Ireland. You know, it's a truism that we hear a lot that the post-famine Irish, they were racialised and then later whitened, you know, how the Irish became white and all that. But I think the Scots-Irish were also initially portrayed as being, you know, ambiguously between white and native. And this was due to their role as a bulwark between Native Americans and longer settled white Europeans. And they sort of perform this role on certain frontiers. However, you know, their status does eventually change and they acquire the much more white Anglo-Saxon label of Scots-Irish. And this sticks, really sticks, after the famine influx of poor Catholic Irish.
Now, one of the best-known Scots-Irish figures was obviously President Andrew Jackson, whose own brother was born in Ireland. Jackson would generally be dismissed as irrelevant to Irish America. Yes, ironically, he's closer to Ireland than JFK or Joe Biden in generational terms. So what does that tell us about Irishness in the USA?
I suppose it tells us that we need to expand, you know, our common and very narrow definition of what is Irish America, which I think we tend to presume it's post-famine, it's white, it's Catholic. But, you know, if you think about the wider, deeper context of the history of the Americas, and I'm using the plural there, if you think about that history, then the Irish have been a presence there for close to 400 years. And I suppose I'm going back to, you know, the forcibly transported Irish in a 17th century plantation zone, and this zone would have stretched from Virginia down into the Caribbean. And then think also of something like, you know, the Ulster Irish, who were a presence in America before it was ever formally recognised as a country.
Jackson was, and I quote from the book, an enslaver and a scourge of Native Americans. Irish people, I would have thought, would probably not be too comfortable with their American heritage being vested in figures like Jackson. But is he actually such an outlier?
Not so much. So, yes, I'll just sort of explain his reputation first. So he instigated the infamous Trail of Tears, and that was the forced westward migration, which thousands of Native Americans died. And he was also an enslaver later in life. You know, I'm naming him as a villain here, but that's not to imply that maybe, you know, Catholics fleeing sectarian Ireland had some kind of innate sympathy then for the oppressed in America. And I found it enlightening really to think about the family and the work of Margaret Mitchell in this regard. Mitchell is, of course, the author of the bestseller Gone with the Wind, a very problematic, really a celebration of an Irish slaveholding family called O'Hara. Mitchell spent much time at her family's ancestral Georgia house, and that had actually been a slave plantation. Her family were of Tipperary Catholic gentry origin. They had built this plantation on land that had been cleared of native presence by no less a person than Andrew Jackson in his early military career. Mitchell's family history, it suggests that the Irish of any and every stripe could be culpable in dealings with peoples of colour in America. I try to stress that the Irish, you know, they fled these very disordered conditions in colonial Ireland. They fled these conditions in the motherland. But then they sometimes, in turn, they victimised the marginalised in the New World themselves. So there was kind of an unthinking replication of everything they were fleeing from at times.
In 1798, the US Congress passed a number of exceptionally illiberal laws. So these were called the Alien and Sedition Acts. There is an Irish association. Tell us how the 1798 rebellion in Ireland actually influenced the passage of these illiberal laws.
I guess I was interested in the fact that it was the radicalised Irish of all stripes, you know, who were involved in the 1798 uprising. And it's important in this context as well to remember that that was, of course, influenced by the French Revolution. So the build-up to 1798 was part of the impetus for these acts that you named, the Alien and Sedition Acts that were passed by the US Congress in that very year of 1798. So the acts were a response to a very strong perception in the 1790s in America that French and Irish, what were called alien forces, that they were conspiring within America. So there was a congressional debate on naturalization, and it was sort of stressed during that, and I love this quotation, that, quote, hordes of wild Irishmen with their incendiary political ideas, that they were not welcome in the land of the free. So at the heart of America's first Gothic novel from 1799, just a year later, and this novel is called Edgar Huntly. So there's a character in this who's an Ulsterman who has done violence in his motherland, and then he flees to colonial Pennsylvania. And I think that this novel suggests that the threat of Irish radicals felt very, very real in the American imagination.
In recent years, there's obviously been a lot of debate in the USA about the notion of white slavery, citing the status of Irish labourers in the Caribbean in the 17th and 18th centuries, the so-called Red Legs. You emphatically describe this as pseudo-history. How did this idea gain currency, and why is it pseudo-history?
So pseudo-history is inaccurate but still popular history, and I think it's gone very viral indeed with the internet. So I'm not going to minimise the suffering or the premature deaths of, you know, many of the Irish who were transported, or even, you know, the deaths of voluntary immigrants, people who went to the 17th century Caribbean. I'm not going to minimise that, but I will stress that the Irish slave rhetoric, the white slave rhetoric, this creates a really false equivalence between indentured servitude, which was brutal but temporary, and the systemic enslavement of people of African origin and their descendants in perpetuity, which was, you know, a very different thing altogether. And I think another complexity to remember, if we're thinking about the Irish, you know, as victims, is that in the Caribbean they were both planter and deportee. And sort of the abject status of the transported Irish shouldn't, I think, efface the role played by some elite Irish there too. I'm really struck by a place like Montserrat in the 17th century in the Caribbean, for instance, which was dominated by a rapacious Irish planter class of predominantly, you know, Catholic Norman origin.
How were the post-famine Irish represented visually? You cover this quite a bit in the book. I'm thinking of the cartoons of Thomas Nast, for example, the simianization of the Irish.
Yeah. So this racist visual representation, you know, of the Irish, it drew from how African Americans were depicted as ape-like, you know, and so the Irish were drawn as low-browed and, you know, physically repulsive. And I think written descriptions also stereotyped the Irish. So it was coming at them, you know, from multiple directions. And that stereotype was that they were lazy and treacherous. And I think it's interesting to remember that the Ulster Irish were also initially, the Scots Irish, initially stereotyped in this way too. There's a 1780s description of this Irish cohort from New York State. And it noted, and I'm going to quote it here, "The Irish do not prosper so well. They love to drink and to quarrel." And of course, that sounds really strikingly like, you know, the later stereotypes of the famine Irish.
Were women, Irish women in particular, or Irish American women, were they subject to simianization as well?
Yes, especially, you know, working immigrant Irish women such as maids. And my book reproduces an interesting 19th century comic Valentine card, which mocks a so-called Irish beauty who possesses, you know, ape-like features.
Now, you've already mentioned Gone with the Wind, Margaret Mitchell. A lot of people will not realise that in Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara's father, Gerald O'Hara, is an Irishman from County Meath, hence the name of the estate, Tara. He has fled to America after getting in trouble in Ireland. You begin your introduction with the fascinating story of a proposed sequel to the novel. What happened there and what does it tell us about Irish America and race?
Yeah, so a few years ago, the Gone with the Wind estate, they asked Pat Conroy to write the sequel to Margaret Mitchell's blockbuster of 1936. He was a fellow Southerner, a fellow Irish American. However, the estate laid down what are, to me, very Irish American conditions, that there could be no homosexuality and no interracial marriage. So after a few months of, you know, struggle and unsuccessful negotiation, the very exasperated Conroy, he presented the estate with the following opening involving the man that plantation belle Scarlett O'Hara marries, Rhett Butler, and another for whom she perennially pines, and that's Ashley. And this is the opening. "After they made love, Rhett turned to Ashley and said, 'Ashley, have I ever told you that my grandmother was black?'" So Conroy's very irreverent anecdote, I think it packs in so, so much. It suggests divergent interpretations of the past between the Irish of different generation or different political outlook. It suggests diverse Irish-American attitudes to race and sexuality. And I suppose on the most basic level, it shows how many seemingly American cultural productions have very strong Irish contexts.
The assumption in Ireland is that the famine's legacy drove Irish-American support of radical nationalist movements in the 19th and early 20th century. However, you also emphasise something I find very interesting, amnesia regarding the famine.
Yeah, so the famine was indeed a powerful motivator within Irish-American nationalism right into the 20th century. But for many actual survivors, it was unnameable. The famine Irish, they were stigmatised, they were, you know, off-white refugees. So they had to suppress that shame, really, in order to, you know, join the white establishment. I found a really interesting example of this was Eugene O'Neill's very successful stage actor father, James. James O'Neill's autobiography neglects to mention that he fled famine as a child. So Eugene's drama is kind of mindful of those kind of traumas and of famine and so on. But I found it very striking that his survivor father wouldn't or couldn't write about this experience himself.
Now, you'd be aware of the controversy over the denaming of the Berkeley Library in Trinity College because of Berkeley's enthusiasm for slavery. Given that John Mitchell's aspiration was for, as you quote in the book yourself, and this is a direct quote from John Mitchell, because we've got to be careful with these things, "a good plantation well stocked with healthy Negroes in Alabama." That's what he wanted, above all. And he was a very effective propagandist for the Confederacy during the US Civil War. So in that context, do you think it's time to reassess his contribution to Irish history?
Well, sure, yeah, it's definitely time to do that. But I think, you know, Mitchell is not some unrepresentative bad apple. I think he really points to a failure of a certain strand of Irish nationalism to make common cause, you know, with other oppressed groups, especially, you know, Native Americans, African Americans. Mitchell had, you know, broken with his former nationalist ally, Daniel O'Connell, and O'Connell had worked to align the causes of Irish nationalism and abolitionism. By contrast, Mitchell, you know, after he escapes to America, his original sympathy for the plight of the degraded Irish poor, this turns into sympathy for what he called the oppression of the slaveholding American South by the North, which, of course, is another, for me, another false equivalency. And I think we need to maybe reassess Irish American history as a whole in relation to race, not just in Mitchell's individual case alone. You know, I'm very struck by, you know, certain facts. For instance, the last illegal transport of human chattel from Africa to the United States was actually undertaken as a wager by a first generation Irish American businessman called Timothy Maher, who was of Kilkenny Jacobite Catholic gentry descent.
And one of the things that surprised me in the book was that that happened in 1860, so only a year before the beginning of the Civil War.
Right.
Theoretically, everything named after John Mitchell in Ireland could be revested in his grandson of the same name, a World War One era mayor of New York, without changing a thing, without changing the name at all. But tell me, why would that be unlikely in the case of John Purroy Mitchell, who was, I think, far from being a chip off the old block where the granddad was concerned?
Yeah, they're a really interesting pairing. So I'll start by saying that in my book, I think about how surnames down the male line are understood as some kind of evidence of loyalties, denomination or ethnicity in Irish America. So I found that the Ulster Presbyterian John Mitchell and his New York mayor grandson with the exact same name, that, you know, they were an interesting case to explore what happens when this kind of assumption doesn't hold true. So Mayor Mitchell, he was at odds with the politics of his grandfather, but his ancestor's reputation among New York's Irish nationalists, it absolutely bedeviled the mayor's public life. He was plagued by it. Mayor Mitchell was raised Catholic, but his republicanism and his reform politics put him at odds with New York's Irish political machine. I think most interestingly, he took on the corrupt Tammany Hall, the Irish Democrat seat of power, as a young lawyer. So the youthful mayor's reformist bent made him very popular with the broader electorate, however, and he was given one of the largest public funerals ever seen by his city at St. Patrick's Cathedral. St. Patrick's, of course, being the symbol of the aspirations of the Irish Catholic New York. So a very thinly disguised Mayor Mitchell actually made it into an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel as a hero. So Mayor Mitchell, he was, you know, an Irish American icon in his day. He's forgotten about to a huge extent, but he certainly wasn't an icon in the mould of his grandfather.
When do you think the Irish finally became white? Was it as late as JFK's accession to the throne, if you like, in 1961, or had it already happened before then?
Yeah, so I'm thinking about, you know, I think the Irish whitened a few times, but in terms of the post-famine Irish, I'd go back to 1956, which is 4 years before Kennedy's election. And that is when Grace Kelly, a woman of famine generation roots, she ascends to the status of Princess of Monaco, in a ceremony that was broadcast live and watched by 30 million people. So that very extravagant ceremony was also explicitly Catholic in a period when Catholicism was still stigmatized in America as the religion of, you know, not quite white immigrants. So I think her globally, this very globally visible ascent, this altered the social status of Irish America. And I think that she paved the way for the rise of another family of famine roots who were called, and I don't think this is a coincidence, America's Royals, and that, of course, being, you know, the Kennedys.
And indeed, the so-called curse of the Kennedy dynasty is a dark chapter you also explore in the book, but we'll have to leave it there for now. Professor Mary Burke is the author of Race, Politics and Irish America, A Gothic History. It's published by Oxford University Press.